one could move about it and see it from any angle. A large section of the galaxy, perhaps a third of the whole, excluding the core, which was a no-life's land, turned red when she touched a contact. That was the Foundation Federation, the more than 7 million inhabited worlds ruled by the Council and by herself, the 7 million inhabited worlds who voted for and were represented in the House of Worlds, which debated matters of minor importance and then voted on them, and never by any chance dealt with anything of major importance. Another contact, and a faint pink jutted outward from the edges of the Federation here and there. Spheres of influence. This was not Foundation territory, but the regions, though nominally independent, would never dream of resistance to any Foundation move. There was no question in her mind that no power in the galaxy could oppose the Foundation, not even the Second Foundation, if one but knew where it was, that the Foundation could, at will, reach out its fleet of modern ships and simply set up the Second Empire. But only 5 centuries had passed since the beginning of the plan. The plan called for 10 centuries before the Second Empire could be set up, and the Second Foundation would make sure the plan would hold. The mayor shook her sad gray head. If the Foundation acted now, it would somehow fail. Though its ships were irresistible, action now would fail. Unless Trevise, the lightning rod, drew the lightning of the Second Foundation, and the lightning could be traced back to its source. She looked about. Where was Codell? This was no time for him to be late. It was as though her thought had called him, for he came striding in, smiling cheerfully, looking more grandfatherly than ever with his gray-white mustache and tanned complexion. Grandfatherly, but not old. To be sure, he was 8 years younger than she was. How was it he showed no marks of strain? Did not 15 years as Director of Security leave its scar? 57. Codell nodded slowly in the formal greeting that was necessary in initiating a discussion with the mayor. It was a tradition that had existed since the bad days of the Inboers. Almost everything had changed, but etiquette least of all. He said, "Sorry I'm late, Mayor, but your arrest of Councilman Trevise is finally beginning to make its way through the anesthetized skin of the council." "Oh," said the mayor phlegmatically, "are we in for a palace revolution?" "Not the least chance. We're in control. But there'll be noise."
"Let them make noise. It will make them feel better, and I shall stay out of the way. I can count, I suppose, on general public opinion?"
"I think you can, especially away from Terminus. No one outside Terminus cares what happens to a stray councilman."
"I do."
"Ah, more news?"
"Leono," said the mayor, "I want to know about Seychelles."
"I'm not a two-legged history book," said Leono Codell, smiling.
"I don't want history. I want the truth. Why is Seychelles independent? Look at it."
She pointed to the red of the Foundation on the holographic map, and there, well into the inner spirals, was an in-pocketing of white. Brano said,
"We've got it almost encapsulated, almost sucked in, yet it's white. Our map doesn't even show it as a loyal ally in pink."
Codell shrugged. "It's not officially a loyal ally, but it never bothers us. It is neutral."
"All right. See this, then."
Another touch at the controls. The red sprang out distinctly further. It covered nearly half the galaxy.
"That," said Mayor Brano, "was the Mule's realm at the time of his death. If you'll peer in among the red, you'll find the Seychelles Union completely surrounded this time, but still white. It is the only enclave left free by the Mule."
"It was neutral then, too."
"The Mule had no great respect for neutrality."
"He seems to have had in this case."
"Seems to have had. What has Seychelles got?"
Codell said, "Nothing. Believe me, Mayor, she is ours any time we want her."
"Is she? Yet somehow she isn't ours."
"There's no need to want her."
Brano sat back in her chair, and with a sweep of her arm over the controls, turned the galaxy dark. "I think we now want her."
"Pardon, Mayor?"
"Leono, I sent that foolish councilman into space as a lightning rod. I felt that the Second Foundation would see him as a greater danger than he was, and see the Foundation itself as the lesser danger. The lightning would strike him and reveal its origin to us."
"Yes, Mayor."
"My intention was that he go to the decayed ruins of Trantor to fumble through what, if anything, was left of its library and search for the Earth. That's the world, you remember, that these wearisome mystics tell us was the site of origin of humanity, as though that matters. Even in the unlikely case, it is true. The Second Foundation couldn't possibly have believed that it was really what he was after, and they would have moved to find out what he was really looking for."
"But he didn't go to Trantor."
"No. Quite unexpectedly, he has gone to Seychelles. Why?"
"I don't know."
But please forgive an old bloodhound whose duty it is to suspect everything, and tell me how you know he and this Pellerat have gone to Seychelles. I know that Kampor reports it, but how far can we trust Kampor?
The hyper-relay tells us that Kampor's ship has indeed landed on Seychelles planet.
Undoubtedly. But how do you know that Trevise and Pellerat have? Kampor may have gone to Seychelles for his own reasons, and may not know or care where the others are.
The fact is that our ambassador on Seychelles has informed us of the arrival of the ship on which we placed Trevise and Pellerat. I am not ready to believe the ship arrived at Seychelles without them. What is more, Kampor reports having talked to them, and if he cannot be trusted, we have other reports placing them at Seychelles University, where they consulted with a historian of no particular note.
None of this, said Caudill mildly, has reached me.
Brano sniffed. Do not feel stepped on. I am dealing with this personally, and the information has now reached you, with not much in the way of a delay either. The latest news just received is from the ambassador. Our lightning rod is moving on. He stayed on Seychelles planet 2 days, then left. He is heading for another planetary system, he says, some 10 parsecs away. He gave the name and the galactic coordinates of his destination to the ambassador, who passed them on to us.
Is there anything corroborative from Kampor?
Kampor's message that Trevise and Pellerat have left Seychelles came even before the ambassador's message. Kampor has not yet determined where Trevise is going. Presumably, he will follow.
Caudill said, We are missing the whys of the situation. He popped a pastille into his mouth and sucked at it meditatively. Why did Trevise go to Seychelles? Why did he leave?
The question that intrigues me most is, where? Where is Trevise going?
You did say, Mayor, did you not, that he gave the name and coordinates of his destination to the ambassador. Are you implying that he lied to the ambassador, or that the ambassador is lying to us?
Even assuming everyone told the truth all round, and that no one made any errors, there is a name that interests me. Trevise told the ambassador he was going to Gaia. That's G-A-I-A. Trevise was careful to spell it.
Caudill said, Gaia? I never heard of it.
Indeed? That's not strange.
Brano pointed to the spot in the air where the map had been.
Upon the map in this room, I can set up at a moment's notice every star, supposedly, around which there circles an inhabited world, and many prominent stars with uninhabited systems. Over 30 million stars can be marked out, if I handle the controls properly, in single units, in pairs, in clusters. I can mark them out in any of 5 different colors, one at a time, or all together. What I cannot do is locate Gaia on the map. As far as the map is concerned, Gaia does not exist.
Caudill said, For every star the map shows, there are 10,000 it doesn't show.
Granted. But the stars it doesn't show lack inhabited planets, and why would Trevise want to go to an uninhabited planet?
Have you tried the central computer? It has all 300 billion galactic stars listed.
I've been told it has. But does it? We know very well, you and I, that there are thousands of inhabited planets that have escaped listing on any of our maps, not only on the one in this room, but even on the central computer. Gaia is apparently one of them.
Caudill's voice remained calm, even coaxing. Mayor, there may well be nothing at all to be concerned about. Trevise may be off on a wild goose chase, or he may be lying to us, and there is no star called Gaia, and no star at all at the coordinates he gave us. He is trying to throw us off his scent now that he has met Kampor and perhaps guesses he is being traced.
How will this throw us off the scent? Kampor will still follow. No, Leono, I have another possibility in mind, one with far greater potentiality for trouble. Listen to me.
She paused and said, This room is shielded, Leono. Understand that. We cannot be overheard by anyone, so please feel free to speak, and I will speak freely as well.
This Gaia is located, if we accept the information, 10 parsecs from Seychelles planet, and is therefore part of the Seychelles Union. The Seychelles Union is a well-explored portion of the galaxy. All its star systems, inhabited or not inhabited, are recorded, and the inhabited ones are known in detail. Gaia is the one exception. Inhabited or not, none have heard of it. It is present in no map. Add to this that the Seychelles Union maintains a peculiar state of independence with respect to the Foundation Federation, and did so even with respect to the Mule's former realm. It has been independent since the fall of the Galactic Empire.
What of all this? Asked Caudill cautiously.
Surely the 2 points I have made must be connected. Seychelles incorporates a planetary system that is totally unknown, and Seychelles is untouchable. The 2 cannot be independent. Whatever Gaia is, it protects itself.
It sees to it that there is no knowledge of its existence outside its immediate surroundings, and it protects those surroundings so that outsiders cannot take over.
You are telling me, Mayor, that Gaia is the seat of the second foundation?
I am telling you that Gaia deserves inspection.
May I mention an odd point that might be difficult to explain by this theory?
Please do.
If Gaia is the second foundation, and if for centuries it has protected itself physically against intruders, protecting all of the Seychelles Union as a broad, deep shield for itself, and if it has even prevented knowledge of itself leaking into the galaxy, then why has all that protection suddenly vanished? Trevise and Pellerat leave Terminus, and even though you had advised them to go to Trantor, they go immediately and without hesitation to Seychelles and now to Gaia. What is more, you can think of Gaia and speculate on it. Why are you not somehow prevented from doing so? Mayor Brano did not answer for a long time. Her head was bent, and her gray hair gleamed dully in the light. Then she said,
"Because I think Councilman Trevise has somehow upset things. He has done something, or is doing something, that is in some way endangering the Selden plan."
"That surely is impossible, Mayor."
"I suppose everything and everyone has its flaws. Even Harry Selden was not perfect, surely. Somewhere the plan has a flaw, and Trevise has stumbled upon it, perhaps without even knowing that he has. We must know what is happening, and we must be on the spot."
Finally, Cadell looked grave. "Don't make decisions on your own, Mayor. We don't want to move without adequate consideration."
"Don't take me for an idiot, Leono. I'm not going to make war. I'm not going to land an expeditionary force on Gaia. I just want to be on the spot, or near it, if you prefer. Leono, find out for me. I hate talking to a war office that is as ridiculously hidebound as one is sure to be after 120 years of peace. But you don't seem to mind. Just how many warships are stationed close to Seychelles? Can we make their movements seem routine and not like a mobilization?"
"In these piping times of peace, there are not many ships in the vicinity, I am sure, but I will find out."
"Even two or three will be sufficient, especially if one is of the supernova class."
"What do you want to do with them?"
"I want them to nudge as close to Seychelles as they can without creating an incident, and I want them sufficiently close to each other to offer mutual support."
"What's all this intended for?"
"Flexibility. I want to be able to strike if I have to."
"Against the second foundation? If Gaia can keep itself isolated and untouchable against the Mule, it can surely withstand a few ships now."
Brano said, with the gleam of battle in her eyes, "My friend, I told you that nothing and no one is perfect, not even Harry Selden. In setting up his plan, he could not help being a person of his times. He was a mathematician of the days of the dying empire, when technology was moribund. It followed that he could not have made sufficient allowance in his plan for technological advance. Gravitics, for instance, is a whole new direction of advance he could not possibly have guessed at. And there are other advances, too."
"Gaia might also have advanced."
"In isolation? Come, there are 10 quadrillion human beings within the Foundation Federation, from among whom contributors to technological advance can step forward. A single isolated world can do nothing in comparison. Our ships will advance, and I will be with them."
"Pardon me, Mayor, what was that?"
"I will be going myself to the ships that will gather at the borders of Seychelles. I wish to see the situation for myself."
Cadell's mouth fell open for a moment. He swallowed and made a distinct noise as he did so. "Mayor, that is not wise." If ever a man clearly intended a stronger remark, Cadell did.
"Wise or not," said Brano violently, "I will do it. I am tired of Terminus and of its endless political battles, its infighting, its alliances and counter-alliances, its betrayals and renewals. I've had 17 years at the center of it, and I want to do something else, anything else. Out there," she waved her hand in a direction taken at random, "the whole history of the galaxy may be changing, and I want to take part in the process."
"You know nothing about such things, Mayor."
"Who does, Leono?"
She rose stiffly to her feet.
"As soon as you bring me the information I need on the ships, and as soon as I can make arrangements for carrying on with the foolish business at home, I will go. And, Leono, don't try to maneuver me out of this decision in any way, or I'll wipe out our long friendship in a stroke and break you. I can still do that."
Cadell nodded. "I know you can, Mayor. But before you decide, may I ask you to reconsider the power of Selden's plan? What you intend may be suicide."
"I have no fears on that score, Leono. It was wrong with respect to the Mule, whom it could not anticipate. and a failure to anticipate at one time implies the possibility of failure at another.
Cadell sighed. Well, then, if you are really determined, I will support you to the best of my ability and with complete loyalty.
Good. I warn you once again that you had better mean that remark with all your heart. And with that in mind, Leono, let us move on to Gaia. Forward.
Chapter 15. Gaia S. 58. Soranovi stepped into the control room of the small and rather old-fashioned ship that was carrying Storj Endebol and herself across the parsecs in deliberate jumps. She had clearly been in the compact cleaning room, where oils, warm air, and a minimum of water freshened her body. She had a robe wrapped about her and was holding it tightly to herself in an agony of modesty. Her hair was dry but tangled. She said in a low voice,
"Master?"
Endebol looked up from his charts and from his computer. "Yes, Novi?"
"I be sorrow-laden."
She paused and then said slowly,
"I am very sorry to bother you, master."
Then she slipped again.
"But I be loss-ridden for my clothing."
"Your clothing?" Endebol stared at her blankly for a moment and then rose to his feet in an excess of contrition. "Novi, I forgot. They needed cleaning, and they're in the detergent hamper. They're cleaned, dried, folded, all set. I should have taken them out and placed them in clear sight. I forgot."
"I did not like to...
She looked down at herself.
"Offend."
"You don't offend," said Endebol cheerily. "Look, I promise you that when this is over, I shall see to it that you have a great deal of clothing, new and in the latest fashion. We left in a hurry, and it never occurred to me to bring a supply. But really, Novi, there are only the two of us, and we'll be together for some time in very close quarters, and it's needless to be so concerned about..." He gestured vaguely, became aware of the horrified look in her eyes, and thought,
"Well, she is only a country girl after all, and has her standards. Probably wouldn't object to improprieties of all kinds, but with her clothes on."
Then he felt ashamed of himself, and was glad that she was no scholar who could sense his thoughts. He said, "Shall I get your clothes for you?"
"Oh, no, master. It be not for you. I know where they are."
He next saw her properly dressed, and with her hair combed. There was a distinct shyness about her.
"I am ashamed, master, to have behaved so improperly. I should have found them for myself."
"No matter," said Endebol. "You are doing very well with your galactic, Novi. You are picking up the language of scholars very quickly." Novi smiled suddenly. Her teeth were somewhat uneven, but that scarcely detracted from the manner in which her face brightened and grew almost sweet unto praise, thought Endebol. He told himself that it was for that reason that he rather liked to praise her.
"The Hamish will think little of me when I am back home," she said. "They will say I am a word chopper. That is what they call someone who speaks odd. They do not like such."
"I doubt that you will be going back to the Hamish, Novi," said Endebol. "I am sure there will continue to be a place for you in the complex, with the scholars, that is, when this is over."
"I would like that, master."
"I don't suppose you would care to call me Speaker Endebol, or just..." "No, I see you wouldn't," he said, responding to her look of scandalized objection. "Oh, well."
"It would not be fitting, master. But may I ask when this will be over?"
Endebol shook his head. "I scarcely know. Right now, I must merely get to a particular place as quickly as I can. This ship, which is a very good ship for its kind, is slow, and as quickly as I can is not very quick. You see," he gestured at the computer and the charts, "I must work out ways to get across large stretches of space, but the computer is limited in its abilities, and I am not very skillful."
"Must you be there quickly, because there is danger, master?"
"What makes you think there is danger, Novi?"
"Because I watch you sometimes, when I don't think you see me, and your face looks, I do not know the word. Not afeard, I mean frightened, and not dead expecting either."
"Apprehensive," muttered Endebol.
"You look concerned. Is that the word?"
"It depends. What do you mean by concern, Novi?"
"I means you look as though you are saying to yourself, what am I going to do next in this great trouble?"
Endebol looked astonished. "That is concerned. But do you see that in my face, Novi? Back in the place of scholars, I am extremely careful that no one should see anything in my face. But I did think that, alone in space, except for you, I could relax and let it sit around in its underwear, so to speak. I'm sorry. That has embarrassed you. What I'm trying to say is that if you're so perceptive, I shall have to be more careful. Every once in a while, I have to relearn the lesson that even non-mentalics can make shrewd guesses." Novi looked blank.
"I don't understand, master."
I'm talking to myself, Novi. Don't be concerned. See, there's that word again.
But is there danger?
There's a problem, Novi. I do not know what I shall find when I reach Seychelles. That is the place to which we are going. I may find myself in a situation of great difficulty.
Does that not mean danger?
No, because I will be able to handle it.
But how can you tell this?
Because I am a scholar, and I am the best of them. There is nothing in the galaxy I cannot handle.
Master,
and something very like agony twisted Novi's face,
I do not wish to give offense and make you angry. I have seen you with that oafish Rufirant, and you were in danger then, and he was only a Hamish farmer. No, I do not know what awaits you, and you know not either.
Gendeval felt chagrined. Are you afraid, Novi?
Not for myself, master. I am afraid for you.
You can say, I fear, muttered Gendeval. That is good galactic, too. For a moment he was engaged in thought. Then he looked up, took Sora Novi's rather coarse hands in his, and said, Novi, I don't want you to fear anything. Let me explain. You know how you could tell there was, or rather might be, danger from the look on my face, almost as though you could read my thoughts?
Yes.
I can read thoughts better than you can. That is what scholars learn to do, and I am a very good scholar.
Novi's eyes widened, and her hand pulled loose from his. She seemed to be holding her breath. You can read my thoughts.
Gendeval held up a finger hurriedly. I don't, Novi. I don't read your thoughts, except when I must. I do not read your thoughts. He knew that in a practical sense he was lying. It was impossible to be with Sora Novi and not understand the general tenor of some of her thoughts. One scarcely needed to be a second foundationer for that. Gendeval felt himself to be on the edge of blushing. But even from a Hamish woman, such an attitude was flattering. And yet she had to be reassured out of common humanity. He said, I can also change the way people think. I can make people feel hurt. I can... But Novi was shaking her head.
How can you do all that, master? Rufirant...
Forget Rufirant, said Gendeval testily. I could have stopped him in a moment. I could have made him fall to the ground. I could have made all the Hamish... He stopped suddenly and felt uneasily that he was boasting, that he was trying to impress this provincial woman, and she was shaking her head still.
Master, she said, you are trying to make me not afraid, but I am not afraid except for you, so there is no need. I know you are a great scholar, and can make this ship fly through space where it seems to me that no person could do aught but, anything but be lost. And you use machines I cannot understand, and that no Hamish person could understand. But you need not tell me of these powers of mind, which surely cannot be so, since all the things you say you could have done to Rufirant you did not do, though you are in danger.
Gendeval pressed his lips together. Leave it at that, he thought. If the woman insists she is not afraid for herself, let it go at that. Yet he did not want her to think of him as a weakling and braggart. He simply did not. He said, If I did nothing to Rufirant, it was because I did not wish to. We scholars must never do anything to the Hamish. We are guests on your world. Do you understand that?
You are our masters. That is what we always say.
For a moment, Gendeval was diverted. How is it, then, that this Rufirant attacked me?
I do not know, she said simply. I don't think he knew. He must have been mind-wandering, out of his mind.
Gendeval grunted. In any case, we do not harm the Hamish. If I had been forced to stop him by hurting him, I might have been poorly thought of by the other scholars, and might perhaps have lost my position. But to save myself being badly hurt, I might have had to handle him just a small bit, the smallest possible. Novi drooped.
Then I need not have come rushing in like a great fool myself.
You did exactly right, said Gendeval. I have just said I would have done ill to have hurt him. You made it unnecessary to do so. You stopped him, and that was well done. I am grateful. You did exactly right, said Gendeval. I have just said I would have done ill to have hurt him. You made it unnecessary to do so. You stopped him, and that was well done. I am grateful. She smiled again, blissfully.
I see, then, why you have been so kind to me.
I was grateful, of course, said Gendeval, a little flustered. But the important thing is that you must understand there is no danger. I can handle an army of ordinary people. Any scholar can, especially the important ones. And I told you I am the best of all of them. There is no one in the galaxy who can stand against me.
If you say so, master, I am sure of it.
I do say so. Now, are you afraid for me?
No, master, except... Master, is it only our scholars who can read minds, and are there other scholars, other places who can oppose you?
For a moment, Jendabal was staggered. The woman had an astonishing gift of penetration. It was necessary to lie. He said, there are none.
But there are so many stars in the sky. I once tried to count them and couldn't. If there are as many worlds of people as there are stars, wouldn't some of them be scholars, besides the scholars on our own world, I mean?
No.
What if there are?
They would not be as strong as I am.
What if they leap upon you suddenly before you are aware?
They cannot do that. If any strange scholar were to approach, I would know at once. I would know it long before he could harm me.
Could you run?
I would not have to run, but, anticipating her objection, if I had to, I could be in a new ship soon, better than any in the galaxy. They would not catch me.
Might they not change your thoughts and make you stay?
No.
There might be many of them. You are but one.
As soon as they are there, long before they can imagine it would be possible, I would know they were there, and I would leave. Our whole world of scholars would then turn against them, and they would not stand. And they would know that, so they would not dare do anything against me. In fact, they would not want me to know of them at all, and yet I will.
Because you are so much better than they,
said Novi, her face shining with a doubtful pride. Jendabal could not resist. Her native intelligence, her quick understanding, was such that it was simple joy to be with her. That soft-voiced monster, Speaker Delora Delarmy, had done him an incredible favor when she had forced this Hamish farm woman upon him. He said, no, Novi, not because I am better than they, although I am. It is because I have you with me.
I?
Exactly, Novi. Had you guessed that?
No, master, she said, wondering. What is it I could do?
It is your mind. He held up his hand at once. I am not reading your thoughts. I see merely the outline of your mind, and it is a smooth outline, an unusually smooth outline. She put her hand to her forehead.
Because I am unlearned, master? Because I am so foolish?
No, dear. He did not notice the manner of address. It is because you are honest and possess no guile, because you are truthful and speak your mind, because you are warm of heart, and other things. If other scholars send out anything to touch our minds, yours and mine, the touch will be instantly visible on the smoothness of your mind. I will be aware of that even before I would be aware of a touch on my own mind, and I will then have time for counteractive strategy, that is, to fight them off. There was a silence for long moments after that. Jendabal realized that it was not just happiness in Novi's eyes, but exultation and pride, too. She said softly,
and you took me with you for that reason?
Jendabal nodded. That was an important reason, yes. Her voice sank to a whisper.
How can I help you as much as possible, master?
He said, remain calm. Don't be afraid. And just stay as you are. She said,
I will stay as I am. And I will stand between you and danger, as I did in the case of Rufirand.
She left the room, and Jendabal looked after her. It was strange how much there was to her. How could so simple a creature hold such complexity? The smoothness of her mind structure had beneath it enormous intelligence, understanding, and courage. What more could he ask of anyone? Somehow, he caught an image of Sura Novi, who was not a speaker, not even a second foundationer, not even educated, grimly at his side, playing a vital auxiliary role in the drama that was coming. Yet he could not see the details clearly. He could not yet see precisely what it was that awaited them. 59. A single jump, muttered Trevise, and there it is.
Gaia?
Asked Pellerat, looking over Trevise's shoulder at the screen. Gaia's son, said Trevise. Call it Gaia S, if you like, to avoid confusion. Galactographers do that sometimes.
And where is Gaia itself, then? Or do we call it Gaia P for planet?
Gaia would be sufficient for the planet. We can't see Gaia yet, however. Planets aren't as easy to see as stars are, and we're still 100 microparsecs away from Gaia S. Notice that it's only a star, even though a very bright one. We're not close enough for it to show as a disk. And don't stare at it directly, Genov. It's still bright enough to damage the retina. I'll throw in a filter. Once I'm through with my observations, then you can stare.
How much is 100 microparsecs in units which a mythologist can understand, Golan?
3 billion kilometers, about 20 times the distance of Terminus from our own sun. Does that help?
Enormously. But shouldn't we get closer?
No. Trevise looked up in surprise. Not right away. After what we've heard about Gaia, why should we rush? It's one thing to have guts. It's another to be crazy.
Let's take a look first. At what, Golan? You said we can't see Gaia yet.
Not at a glance, no. But we have telescopic viewers, and we have an excellent computer for rapid analysis. We can certainly study Gaia S to begin with, and we can perhaps make a few other observations.
Relax, Janov. He reached out and slapped the other's shoulder with an avuncular flourish.
After a pause, Treves said, Gaia S is a single star, or if it has a companion, that companion is much farther away from it than we are at the present moment, and it is at best a red dwarf, which means we need not be concerned with it. Gaia S is a G4 star, which means it is perfectly capable of having a habitable planet, and that's good. If it were an A or an M, we would have to turn around and leave right now.
Pellaret said, I may be only a mythologist, but couldn't we have determined the spectral class of Gaia S from Seychelles?
We could, and we did, Janov, but it never hurts to check at closer quarters. Gaia S has a planetary system, which is no surprise. There are two gas giants in view, and one of them is nice and large, if the computer's distance estimate is correct. There could easily be another on the other side of the star, and therefore not easily detectable, since we happen, by chance, to be somewhat close to the planetary plane. I can't make out anything in the inner regions, which is also no surprise.
Is that bad?
Not really. It's expected. The habitable planets would be of rock and metal, and would be much smaller than the gas giants, and much closer to the star, if they're to be warm enough. And on both counts, they would be much harder to see from out here. It means we'll have to get in considerably closer in order to probe the area within 4 microparsecs of Gaia S.
I'm ready.
I'm not. We'll make the jump tomorrow.
Why tomorrow?
Why not? Let's give them a day to come out and get us, and for us to get away, perhaps, if we spot them coming and don't like what we see.
60.
It was a slow and cautious process. During the day that passed, Treves grimly directed the calculation of several different approaches and tried to choose between them. Lacking hard data, he could depend only on intuition, which, unfortunately, told him nothing. He lacked that sureness he sometimes experienced. Eventually, he punched in directions for a jump that moved them far out of the planetary plane.
That'll give us a better view of the region as a whole, he said, since we will see the planets in every part of their orbit at maximum apparent distance from the sun. And they, whoever they may be, might not be quite as watchful over regions outside the plane. I hope.
They were now as close to Gaia S as the nearest and largest of the gas giants was, and they were nearly 500 million kilometers from it. Treves placed it under full magnification on the screen for Pellaret's benefit. It was an impressive sight, even if the 3 sparse and narrow rings of debris were left out of account.
It has the usual train of satellites, said Treves, but at this distance from Gaia S we know that none of them are habitable. Nor are any of them settled by human beings who survive, let us say, under a glass dome or under other strictly artificial conditions.
How can you tell?
There's no radio noise with characteristics that point them out as of intelligent origin. Of course, he added, qualifying his statement at once, it is conceivable that a scientific outpost might go to great pains to shield its radio signals, and the gas giant produces radio noise that could mask what I was looking for.
Still, our radio reception is delicate, and our computer is an extraordinarily good one. I'd say the chance of human occupation of those satellites is extremely small.
Does that mean there's no Gaia?
No, but it does mean that if there is a Gaia, it hasn't bothered to settle those satellites. Perhaps it lacks the capacity to do so, or the interest.
Well, is there a Gaia?
Patience, Janov, patience.
Treves considered the sky with a seemingly endless supply of patience. He stopped at one point to say, Frankly, the fact that they haven't come out to pounce on us is disheartening in a way. Surely if they had the capacities they were described as having, they would have reacted to us by now.
It's conceivable, I suppose, said Pellaret glumly, that the whole thing is a fantasy.
Call it a myth, Janov, said Treves with a wry smile, and it'll be right up your alley.
Still, there's a planet moving through the ichosphere, which means it might be habitable. I'll want to observe it for at least a day.
Why?
To make sure it's habitable, for one thing.
You just said it was in the ecosphere, Golan.
Yes, at the moment it is. But its orbit could be very eccentric, and could eventually carry it within a microparsec of the star, or out to 15 microparsecs, or both. We'll have to determine and compare the planet's distance from Gaia S with its orbital speed, and it would help to note the direction of its motion.
61. Another day.
The orbit is nearly circular, Treves said finally, which means that habitability becomes a much safer bet. Yet no one's coming out to get us even now. We'll have to try a closer look.
Pellaret said, Why does it take so long to arrange a jump? You're just taking little ones. Listen to the man. Little jumps are harder to control than big ones. Is it easier to pick up a rock or a fine grain of sand? Besides, Gaia S is nearby and space is sharply curved. That complicates the calculations, even for the computer. Even a mythologist should see that. Pellerat grunted. Treviz said, You can see the planet with the unaided eye now. Right there. See it? The period of rotation is about 22 galactic hours, and the axial inclination is 12 degrees. It is practically a textbook example of a habitable planet, and it is life-bearing.
How can you tell?
There are substantial quantities of free oxygen in the atmosphere. You can't have that without well-established vegetation.
What about intelligent life?
That depends on the analysis of radio wave radiation. Of course, there could be intelligent life that has abandoned technology, I suppose, but that seems very unlikely.
There have been cases of that, said Pellerat.
I'll take your word for it. That's your department. However, it's not likely that there would be nothing but pastoral survivors on a planet that frightened off the mule. Pellerat said,
Does it have a satellite?
Yes, it does, said Treviz casually.
How big?
Pellerat said in a voice that was suddenly choking. Can't tell for sure. Perhaps 100 kilometers across.
Dear me, said Pellerat wistfully. I wish I had some worthier set of expletives on instant call, my dear chap, but there was just that one little chance.
You mean if it had a giant satellite, it might be Earth itself?
Yes, but it clearly isn't.
Well, if Kompor is right, Earth wouldn't be in this galactic region anyway. It would be over Sirius way. Really, Janoff, I'm sorry.
Oh, well.
Look, we'll wait and risk one more small jump. If we find no signs of intelligent life, then it should be safe to land, except that there will then be no reason to land, will there? 62. After the next jump, Treviz said in an astonished voice, That does it, Janoff. It's Gaia, all right. At least it possesses a technological civilization.
Can you tell that from the radio waves?
Better than that. There's a space station circling the planet. Do you see that? There was an object on display on the view screen. To Pellerat's unaccustomed eye, it didn't seem very remarkable, but Treviz said, Artificial, metallic, and a radio source.
What do we do now?
Nothing for a while. At this stage of technology, they cannot fail to detect us. If, after a while, they do nothing, I will beam a radio message at them. If they still do nothing, I will approach cautiously.
What if they do something?
It will depend on the something. If I don't like it, then I'll have to take advantage of the fact that it is very unlikely that they have anything that can match the facility with which this ship can make a jump.
You mean we'll leave?
Like a hyperspatial missile.
But we'll leave no wiser than we came.
Not at all. At the very least, we'll know that Gaia exists, that it has a working technology, and that it's done something to scare us.
But, Golan, let's not be too easily scared.
Now, Janoff, I know that you want nothing more in the galaxy than to learn about Earth at any cost, but please remember that I don't share your monomania. We are in an unarmed ship, and those people down there have been isolated for centuries. Suppose they have never heard of the Foundation and don't know enough to be respectful of it. Or suppose this is the second Foundation, and once we're in their grip, if they're annoyed with us, we may never be the same again. Do you want them to wipe your mind clear and find you are no longer a mythologist and know nothing about any legends whatever? Pellerat looked grim.
If you put it that way. But what do we do once we leave?
Simple. We get back to Terminus with the news, or as near to Terminus as the old woman will allow. Then we might return to Gaia once again, more quickly, and without all this inching along, and we return with an armed ship or an armed fleet. Things may well be different then. 63. They waited. It had grown to be a routine. They had spent far more time waiting in the approaches to Gaia than they had spent in all the flight from Terminus to Seychelles. Treviz set the computer to automatic alarm and was even nonchalant enough to doze in his padded chair. This meant he awoke with a start when the alarm chimed. Pellerat came into Therese's room just as startled. He had been interrupted while shaving.
Have we received a message? Said Pellerat.
No, said Treviz energetically. We're moving.
Moving? Where?
Toward the space station.
Why is that?
I don't know. The motors are on, and the computer doesn't respond to me, but we're moving. Janoff, we've been seized. We've come a little too close to Gaia. Chapter 16. Convergence. 64. When Stor Jendebal finally made out Kompor's ship on his viewscreen, it seemed like the end of an incredibly long journey. Yet, of course, it was not the end, but merely the beginning. The journey from Trantor to Seychelles had been nothing but prologue.
Novi looked odd.
Is that another ship of space, Master?
Spaceship, Novi. It is. It's the one we've been striving to reach. It is a larger ship than this one, and a better one. It can move through space so quickly that if it fled from us, this ship could not possibly catch it or even follow it.
Faster than a ship of the Master's?
Sora Novi seemed appalled by the thought. Jendabal shrugged. I may be, as you say, a master, but I am not a master in all things. We scholars do not have ships like these, nor do we have many of the material devices that the owners of those ships have.
But who can scholars lock such things, Master?
Because we are masters in what is important. The material advances that these others have are trifles. Novi's brows bent together in thought.
It seemed to me that to go so quickly that a master cannot follow is no trifle. Who are these people who are wonder-having, who have such things?
Jendabal was amused. They call themselves the Foundation. Have you ever heard of the Foundation? He caught himself wondering what the Hamish knew or did not know of the galaxy, and why it never occurred to the speakers to wonder about such things. Or was it only he who had never wondered about such things? Only he who assumed that the Hamish cared for nothing more than grubbing in the soil? Novi shook her head thoughtfully.
I have never heard of it, Master. When the schoolmaster taught me letter roar, how to read, I mean, he told me there were many other worlds, and told me the names of some. He said our Hamish world had the proper name of Trantor, and that it once ruled all the worlds. He said Trantor was covered with gleaming iron, and had an emperor who was an all-master.
Her eyes looked up at Jendabal with a shy merriment.
I unbelieve most of it, though. There are many stories the word-spinners tell in the meeting halls in the time of longer nights. When I was a small girl, I believed them all. But as I grew older, I found that many of them were not true. I believe very few know, perhaps none. Even schoolmasters tell unbelievables.
Just the same, Novi, that particular story of the schoolmaster is true, but it was long ago. Trantor was indeed covered by metal, and had indeed an emperor who ruled all the galaxy. Now, however, it is the people of the Foundation who will someday rule all the worlds. They grow stronger all the time.
Will they rule all, Master?
Not immediately. In 500 years.
And they will master the Masters as well?
No, no. They will rule the worlds. We will rule them for their safety and the safety of all the worlds.
Novi was frowning again. She said, Master, do these people at the Foundation have many of these remarkable ships?
I imagine so, Novi.
And other things that are very astonishing?
They have powerful weapons of all kinds.
Then, Master, can they not take all the worlds new?
No, they cannot. It is not yet time.
But why can they not? Would the Master stop them?
We wouldn't have to, Novi. Even if we did nothing, they could not take all the worlds.
But what would stop them?
You see, began Jendabal, there is a plan that a wise man once devised. He stopped, smiled slightly, and shook his head. It is hard to explain, Novi. Another time, perhaps. In fact, when you see what will happen before we ever see Trantor again, you may even understand without my explaining.
What will happen, Master?
I am not sure, Novi, but all will happen well. He turned away and prepared to make contact with Kompor, and as he did so, he could not quite keep an inner thought from saying, at least I hope so. He was instantly angry with himself, for he knew the source of that foolish and weakening drift of thought. It was the picture of the elaborate and enormous Foundation might in the shape of Kompor's ship, and it was his chagrin at Novi's open admiration of it. Stupid. How could he let himself compare the possession of mere strength and power with the possession of the ability to guide events? It was what generations of speakers had called the fallacy of the hand at the throat. To think that he was not yet immune to its allures. 65. Munli Kompor was not in the least sure as to how he ought to comport himself. For most of his life, he had had the vision of all-powerful speakers existing just beyond his circle of experience. Speakers, with whom he was occasionally in contact, and who had in their mysterious grip the whole of humanity. Of them all, it had been Stor Jendabal to whom in recent years he had turned for direction. It was not even a voice he had encountered most times, but a mere presence in his mind, hyperspeech without a hyper-relay. In this respect, the Second Foundation had gone far beyond the Foundation. Without material device, but just by the educated and advanced power of the mind alone, they could reach across the parsecs in a manner that could not be tapped, could not be infringed upon. It was an invisible, indetectable network that held all the worlds fast through the mediation of a relatively few dedicated individuals. Kompor had more than once experienced a kind of uplifting at the thought of his role. How small the band of which he was one, how enormous an influence they exerted,
and how secret it all was. Even his wife knew nothing of his hidden life. And it was the speakers who held the strings. And this one speaker, this Jendabal, who might, Kampor thought, be the next first speaker, the more-than-emperor of a more-than-empire. Now Jendabal was here, in a ship of Trantor, and Kampor fought to stifle his disappointment at not having such a meeting take place on Trantor itself. Could that be a ship of Trantor? Any of the early traders who had carried the Foundation's wares through a hostile galaxy would have had a better ship than that. No wonder it had taken the speaker so long to cover the distance from Trantor to Seychelles. It was not even equipped with an unidock mechanism that would have welded the two ships into one when the cross-transfer of personnel was desired. Even the contemptible Seychellian fleet was equipped with it. Instead, the speaker had to match velocities and then cast a tether across the gap and swing along it, as in Imperial days. That was it, thought Kampor gloomily, unable to repress the feeling. The ship was no more than an old-fashioned Imperial vessel, and a small one at that. Two figures were moving across the tether, one of them so clumsily that it was clear it had never attempted to maneuver through space before. Finally, they were on board and removed their spacesuits. Speaker Stor Jendabal was of moderate height and of unimpressive appearance. He was not large and powerful, nor did he exude an air of learning. His dark, deep-set eyes were the only indication of his wisdom. But now the speaker looked about with a clear indication of being in awe himself. The other was a woman, as tall as Jendabal, plain in appearance. Her mouth was open in astonishment as she looked about. 66. Moving across the tether had not been an entirely unpleasant experience for Jendabal. He was not a spaceman, no second foundationer was, but neither was he a complete surface worm, for no second foundationer was allowed to be that. The possible need for spaceflight was, after all, always looming above them, though every second foundationer hoped the need would arise only infrequently. Preem Palver, the extent of whose space travels was legendary, had once said ruefully that the measure of the success of a speaker was the fewness of the times he was compelled to move through space in order to assure the success of the plan. Jendabal had had to use a tether three times before. This was his fourth use, and even if he had felt tension over the matter, it would have disappeared in his concern for Sura Novi. He needed no mentalics to see that stepping into nothingness had totally upset her.
"I be afeared, master," she said, when he explained what would have to be done. "It be notness into which I will make footstep."
If nothing else, her sudden descent into thick Hamish dialect showed the extent of her disturbance. Jendabal said gently, "I cannot leave you on board this ship, Novi, for I will be going into the other, and I must have you with me. There is no danger, for your spacesuit will protect you from all harm, and there is no place for you to fall to. Even if you lose your grip on the tether, you will remain nearly where you are, and I will be within arm's reach so that I can gather you in. Come, Novi, show me that you are brave enough as well as bright enough to become a scholar." She made no further objection, and Jendabal, unwilling to do anything that might disturb the smoothness of her mindset, nevertheless managed to inject a soothing touch upon the surface of her mind. "You can still speak to me," he said, after they were each enclosed in the spacesuit. "I can hear you if you think hard. Think the words hard and clearly, one by one. You can hear me now, can't you?"
"Yes, master," she said.
He could see her lips move through the transparent faceplate, and he said, "Say it without moving your lips, Novi. There is no radio in the kind of suits that scholars have. It is all done with the mind." Her lips did not move, and her look grew more anxious.
"Can you hear me, master?"
"Perfectly well," thought Jendabal, and his lips did not move either. "Do you hear me?"
"I do, master."
"Then come with me and do as I do." They moved across. Jendabal knew the theory of it, even if he could handle the practice only moderately well. The trick was to keep one's legs extended and together, and to swing them from the hips alone. That kept the center of gravity moving in a straight line as the arms swung forward in steady alternation. He had explained this to Sura Novi, and without turning to look at her, he studied the stance of her body from the set of the motor areas of her brain. For a first-timer, she did very well, almost as well as Jendabal was managing to do. She repressed her own tensions, and she followed directions. Jendabal found himself once again very pleased with her. She was, however, clearly glad to be on board ship again, and so was Jendabal. He looked about as he removed his spacesuit and was rather dumbfounded at the luxury and style of the equipment. He recognized almost nothing, and his heart sank at the thought that he might have very little time to learn how to handle it all. He might have to transfer expertise directly from the man already on board, something that was never quite as satisfactory as true learning. Then he concentrated on Kampor.
Kapoor was tall and lean, a few years older than himself, rather handsome in a slightly weak way, with tightly waved hair of a startling buttery yellow. And it was clear to Jindabal that this person was disappointed in and even contemptuous of the speaker he was now meeting for the first time. What was more, he was entirely unsuccessful in hiding the fact. Jindabal did not mind such things on the whole. Kapoor was not a Trantorian, nor a full second foundationer, and he clearly had his illusions. Even the most superficial scan of his mind showed that. Among these was the illusion that true power was necessarily related to the appearance of power. He might, of course, keep his illusions as long as they did not interfere with what Jindabal needed, but at the present moment, this particular illusion did so interfere. What Jindabal did was the mentalic equivalent of a snap of the fingers. Kapoor staggered slightly under the impress of a sharp but fleeting pain. There was an impress of enforced concentration that puckered the skin of his thought and left the man with the awareness of a casual but awesome power that could be utilized if the speaker chose. Kapoor was left with a vast respect for Jindabal. Jindabal said pleasantly, "I am merely attracting your attention, Kapoor, my friend. Please let me know the present whereabouts of your friend Golan Trevise and his friend Janoth Pellerat." Kapoor said hesitantly, "Shall I speak in the presence of the woman speaker?" "The woman, Kapoor, is an extension of myself. There is no reason, therefore, why you should not speak openly."
"As you say, Speaker. Trevise and Pellerat are now approaching the planet known as Gaia."
"So you said in your last communication the other day. Surely they have already landed on Gaia and perhaps left again. They did not stay long on Seychelles planet."
"They had not yet landed during the time I followed them, Speaker. They were approaching the planet with great caution, pausing substantial periods between micro-jumps. It is clear to me they have no information about the planet they are approaching, and therefore hesitate."
"Do you have information, Kapoor?"
"I have none, Speaker," said Kapoor. "Or at least my ship's computer has none."
"This computer?" Jindabal's eyes fell upon the control panel, and he asked in sudden hope, "Can it aid usefully in running the ship?"
"It can run the ship completely, Speaker. One need merely think into it."
Jindabal felt suddenly uneasy. "The Foundation has gone that far?"
"Yes, but clumsily. The computer does not work well. I must repeat my thoughts several times, and even then I get but minimal information."
Jindabal said, "I may be able to do better than that."
"I am sure of it, Speaker," said Kapoor respectfully.
"But never mind that for the moment. Why does it have no information on Gaia?"
"I do not know, Speaker. It claims to have, as far as a computer may be said to be able to claim, records on every human inhabited planet in the galaxy."
"It cannot have more information that has been fed into it, and if those who did the feeding thought they had records of all such planets, when in actual fact they had not, then the computer would labor under the same misapprehension, correct?"
"Certainly, Speaker."
"Did you inquire at Seychelles?"
"Speaker," said Kapoor uneasily, "there are people who speak of Gaia on Seychelles, but what they say is valueless. Clearly superstition. The tale they tell is that Gaia is a powerful world that held off even the mule."
"Is that what they say indeed?" said Jindabal, suppressing excitement. "Were you so sure that this was superstition that you asked for no details?"
"No, Speaker. I asked a great deal. But what I have just told you is all that anyone can say. They can speak on the subject at great length, but when they have done so, all that it boils down to is what I have just said."
"Apparently," said Jindabal, "that is what Trevise has heard, too, and he goes to Gaia for some reason connected with that, to tap this great power, perhaps, and he does so cautiously, for perhaps he also fears this great power."
"That is certainly possible, Speaker."
"And yet you did not follow?"
"I did follow, Speaker, long enough to make sure he was indeed making for Gaia. I then returned here to the outskirts of the Gaian system."
"Why?"
"Three reasons, Speaker. First, you were about to arrive, and I wanted to meet you at least part way and bring you aboard at the earliest moment, as you had directed. Since my ship has a hyper-relay on board, I could not move too far away from Trevise and Pellerat without rousing suspicion on Terminus, but I judged I could risk moving this far. Second, when it was clear that Trevise was approaching Gaia planet very slowly, I judged there would be time enough for me to move toward you and hasten our meeting without being overtaken by events, especially since you would be more competent than I to follow him to the planet itself and to handle any emergency that might arise."
"Quite true. And the third reason?"
"Since our last communication, Speaker, something has happened that I did not expect and do not understand. I felt that, for that reason, too, I had better hasten our meeting as soon as I dared."
"And this event that you did not expect and do not understand?"
"Ships of the Foundation fleet are approaching the Seychellian frontier. My computer has picked up this information from Seychellian news broadcasts, At least 5 advanced ships are in the flotilla, and these have enough power to overwhelm Seychelles.
Gendebal did not answer at once, for it would not do to show that he had not expected such a move, or that he didn't understand it. So, after a moment, he said negligently, "Do you suppose that this has something to do with Trevise's movement toward Gaia?"
"It certainly came immediately afterward, and if B follows A, then there is at least a possibility that A caused B," said Campor.
"Well, then, it seems we all converge upon Gaia, Trevise and I, and the First Foundation. Come, you acted well, Campor," said Gendebal. "And here is what we will now do. First, you will show me how this computer works, and through that, how the ship may be handled. I am sure that will not take long. After that, you will get into my ship, since by then I will have impressed on your mind how to handle it. You will have no trouble maneuvering it, although I must tell you, as you have no doubt guessed from its appearance, that you will find it primitive indeed. Once you are in control of the ship, you will keep it here and wait for me."
"How long, Speaker?"
"Until I come for you. I do not expect to be gone long enough for you to be in danger of running out of supplies, but if I am unduly delayed, you may find your way to some inhabited planet of the Seychelles Union and wait there. Wherever you are, I will find you."
"As you say, Speaker."
"And do not be alarmed. I can handle this mysterious Gaia, and if need be, the 5 ships of the Foundation as well."
67. Littoral Tubing had been the Foundation's ambassador to Seychelles for 7 years. He rather liked the position. Tall and rather stout, he wore a thick brown mustache at a time when the predominant fashion, both in the Foundation and in Seychelles, was smooth-shaven. He had a strongly lined countenance, though he was only 54, and was much given to a schooled indifference. His attitude toward his work was not easily seen. Still, he rather liked the position. It kept him away from the hurly-burly of politics on Terminus, something he appreciated, and it gave him the chance to live the life of a Seychellian Sybarite and to support his wife and daughter in the style to which they had become addicted. He didn't want his life disturbed. On the other hand, he rather disliked Leono Codel, perhaps because Codel also sported a mustache, though one which was smaller, shorter, and grayish-white. In the old days, they had been the only 2 people in prominent public life who had worn one, and there had been rather a competition between them over the matter. Now, thought Tubing, there was none. Codel's was contemptible. Codel had been director of security when Tubing was still on Terminus, dreaming of opposing Harlow Brano in the race for mayor. Until he had been bought off with the ambassadorship, Brano had done it for her own sake, of course, but he had ended up owing her goodwill for that. But not to Codel, somehow. Perhaps it was because of Codel's determined cheerfulness, the manner in which he was always such a friendly person, even after he had decided on just exactly the manner in which your throat was to be cut. Now he sat there in hyperspatial image, cheerful as ever, brimming over with bonhomie. His actual body was, of course, back on Terminus, which spared Tubing the necessity of offering him any physical sign of hospitality.
"Codel," he said, "I want those ships withdrawn."
Codel smiled sunnily.
"Why, so do I. But the old lady has made up her mind." "You've been known to persuade her out of this or that."
"On occasion, perhaps, when she wanted to be persuaded. This time she doesn't want to be. Tubing, do your job. Keep Seychelles calm."
"I'm not thinking about Seychelles, Codel. I'm thinking about the Foundation."
"So are we all."
"Codel, don't fence. I want you to listen to me."
"Gladly. But these are hectic times on Terminus, and I will not listen to you forever."
"I will be as brief as I can be when discussing the possibility of the Foundation's destruction. If this hyperspatial line is not being tapped, I will speak openly."
"It is not being tapped."
"Then let me go on. I have received a message some days ago from one Golan Trevise. I recall a Trevise in my own political days, a commissioner of transportation."
"The young man's uncle," Goodell said.
"Ah, then you know the Trevise who sent the message to me. According to the information I have since gathered, he was a councilman who, after the recent successful resolution of a Selden crisis, was arrested and sent into exile."
"Exactly."
"I don't believe it."
"What is it that you don't believe?"
"That he was sent into exile."
"Why not?"
"When in history has any citizen of the Foundation been sent into exile?" demanded Tubing. "He is arrested or not arrested. If he is arrested, he is tried or not tried. If he is tried, he is convicted or not convicted. If he is convicted, he is fined, demoted, disgraced, imprisoned, or executed. No one is sent into exile."
"There is always a first time."
"Nonsense. In an advanced naval vessel? What fool can fail to see that he is on a special mission for your old woman? Whom can she possibly expect to deceive?"
"What would the mission be?"
"Supposedly to find the planet Gaia."
Some of the cheerfulness left Goodell's face. An unaccustomed hardness entered his eyes. He said, "I know that you feel no overwhelming impulse to believe my statements, Mr. Ambassador, but I make a special plea that you believe me in this one case.
Neither the mayor nor I had ever heard of Gaia at the time that Trevise was sent into exile. We have heard of Gaia for the first time just the other day. If you believe that, this conversation may continue. I will suspend my tendency toward skepticism long enough to accept that, Director, though it is difficult to do so.
It is quite true, Mr. Ambassador. And if I have suddenly adopted a formal note to my statements, it is because, when this is done, you will find that you have questions to answer, and that you will not find the occasion joyful. You speak as though...